Okay, the first thing I was going to ask you about is just to give the listeners a general idea of the way your career is right now, what types of patients you see, what type of practice you have, and then how you balance that with your home life and family life, that type of thing.
Okay. Well, my practice is general OBGYN. Mm-hmm. I see probably a little bit more gynecology patients than obstetrics.
Mm-hmm.
I don't do any subspecialty work within OBGYN. And includes kind of the routine for what most people do as far as OBGYN surgery, obviously office practice, and then labor and delivery, you know, delivery of babies. As far as balancing that with my home life, I'm married, so have to kind of finagle sometimes, but I plan things around, you know, my call schedule, or if I know events are coming up, I plan my call schedule, you know, around events, and try to spend as much time with my husband as I'm able to. He's a social worker, so that his hours are long also, so sometimes it makes it difficult.
And maybe I can just go back a little bit. I noticed you're younger than a lot of the other people we're interviewing, so you must have graduated how many years have you been in practice for?
I've been in practice for almost 5 years.
5 years. So you finished your residency, and is this the first
in 91, time? Yeah.
Okay. What do you think of it here? What do you think of your work? Is it what you thought it would be?
Pretty much. I pretty much knew what I was getting into. When I was looking for a practice to join, I was looking for a small specialty group practice that was associated with an academic center. And so it's pretty much been what I've expected for the most part.
And why Worcester?
Because it's in Massachusetts, basically. Yeah, I wanted to be close to my family and friends. And most of my family's in Massachusetts, and my friends are all in New England. So that's really the main reason why I chose here.
So did you grow up here?
Yeah, I grew up in Massachusetts.
Okay. Are you a UMass graduate, or?
No, I'm not from UMass. No, I went to medical school at Duke University. Yeah, North Carolina. Yeah. I was looking for a change, and I really liked it down there. I thought a lot about staying in North Carolina, but all of my friends from medical school were going all different directions. So taking into account the expected strains of residency, I figured it was best to head back to Massachusetts, where I had the support of my friends and family. So I did my training in Springfield, Mass, and then I came here from there.
Okay, tell me about what made you go into medicine.
A lot of things. Primarily an interest in science, and an even stronger interest in the human body, and a desire to be in a profession where I can help people, you know, basically. Is really what it comes down to. I always had curiosity about, all science, but particularly the human body and its functions, and kind of followed. I was actually initially considering being a dentist and then a veterinarian.
Going back to when you were a kid.
Yeah, when I was a teenager, I thought I wanted to be a dentist.
Why?
For some reason, teeth fascinated me. I don't know why. When I first learned about them and, you know, what they're all about.
Did you like going to the dentist?
I did not like going to the dentist, but I just thought they were interesting, and I thought it would be a good life to have. But then I decided I wouldn't want to spend the rest of my life working in people's mouths. So I strongly considered veterinary medicine. I was pre-vet when I first went to college, and that partly out of a love of animals. But having grown up in the suburbs, what I found is I did a couple of veterinary jobs, especially with large animals. I found I really wasn't quite the veterinary type of person. I like large animals, but I found a lot different, of course, working with them than just learning about them, reading about them, and observing them. So from there, I started thinking about human medicine.
So human medicine was kind of a default from an initial interest in
veterinary medicine.
And what kind of family life did you have in terms of encouraging you to go into medicine, or what kind of goals did they want you to...
I had a lot of encouragement. My father majored in biology in college, and I think he really spawned a lot of my interest in science. I can remember when I was very young, he used to buy me science-oriented type of, I'll call them toys, but I mean things that kind of sparked my interest in books, and we used to look under a microscope together at things and stuff like that. So he really kind of, I think, really piqued my interest in a lot of scientific matters. And both my parents were very supportive. Mm-hmm. And I have, my maternal grandmother was a big support person in my life. Mm-hmm. She was always there for me, very supportive and very proud, as of everybody else. So I had a lot of support and a lot of interest from way back when.
And brothers and sisters?
I have a younger brother and a younger sister. And it was actually my younger brother who got me thinking about being a veterinarian. He was thinking of it before I was. And to his interest, I think, got me more interested in that possibility. He's now a lawyer, so that shows you where that went. But both my brother and sister have interest in science, too. My brother more so than myself.
And where did you grow up?
In Newton, Massachusetts.
Tell me a little bit more about your maternal grandmother, because I know you said that she played a supportive role, but can you be more specific, maybe anecdotal?
Well, interestingly enough, she grew up in Worcester. Not that that had any influence in my coming here, although I did have probably a little bit of familiarity with the area because of it, but my grandmother, she was always kind of like a friend to me as much as a grandmother. I always felt like I could talk to her, you know, about anything and everything. And I have the same sort of relationship with my mother, but my maternal grandmother was the one of my grandparents that really stands out in my mind when I think about people who really helped me get to being an MD. Because even when I was in, it's not so much in high school because the stresses weren't there, but when I was in college and dealing with pre-med courses and then medical school and applications and board exams and all that sort of thing, you know, when I get stressed out, she was usually the person I would call. If not my mother, you know, I'd always be talking to my friends about stuff like that, but she was one of my big support people, and she just always had the message to me that she knew I could do it, and for that matter, she knew I should do it. It's kind of the way she put it, just because I had the capability to. I mean, my grandmother, coming from a different generation, and particularly a generation of African Americans, had a strong feeling that, you know, people had to excel to the best that they could despite odds against them. And so I think since she saw that I had the capability, she felt all the more, you know, need to support me. So she was just a good emotional support person. She herself worked as a speech therapist. She did some college work, had an associate degree, and then subsequently worked as in child care, mm-hmm. In individual homes. And so she kind of had that background too, of working with people and helping people through illnesses and difficulties.
And how about your mom?
My mom is a computer engineer.
Oh,
my mom
too.
Oh, really? Yeah. She gave me all the math impetus and working with numbers, although I don't have her mind for numbers at all, mm-hmm. by a long shot. But my mom is definitely my absolute biggest support person, because like I say, my grandmother too, but my mother and my grandmother, I consider them best friends, in addition to being relatives, and particularly from the time I've been an adult, which I kind of consider that when I graduated high school, I've always felt extremely close to my mother. I mean, growing up as a child, but as an adult, close friendship, and she's always been there for me.
And did you used to come to Worcester as a kid to stay with your grandmother?
No, because when my grandmother lived in Worcester was when she was a child herself.
Okay.
Yeah, she grew up in Worcester as a child, and then when she was married, she moved to Medford, Mass. Mm-hmm. So that's where, when I was first alive, that's where she lived. So, but she used to tell me stories about Worcester because she grew up on a farm in Worcester, and the stories she tells are interesting because they always were very vivid in describing very much a small farm type of life. It was interesting to hear her talk about, you know, churning butter and getting the eggs in the morning and all that kind of stuff that you only ever, you know, saw on TV. So.
Going back to your career, how did you decide to go into a certain specialty?
Well, it wasn't an easy decision, that's for sure. When I did my clinical rotations in medical school, I pretty much liked everything I did and actually considered going into just about every specialty. Initially, when I went to medical school, I was planning on doing pediatrics because I enjoy children a lot. And but when I did the actual rotation, what I found is that I wanted something that had a little more variety than what, you know, typical pediatrics have. And I considered doing some subspecialty work in pediatrics, but then toward the end of my clinical year, when I did obstetrics and gynecology, I got pretty turned on to that just because it gave me the possibility of a lot more variety, but a lot of the same things that I enjoyed about pediatrics. And I really do love a variety a lot. That is a real big thing for me. But my final decision came down to family medicine or OBGYN because of the variety. And also, too, the main other thing being the ability to do a lot of preventive care as opposed to, you know, treatment of disease. So those are really the two, you know, main things. And the main thing that ultimately made up my mind, two things. Number one, being able to deliver babies, which I wasn't sure I'd be able to do as a family practitioner, the way medicine's been going, and malpractice and all that. And the main other thing is surgery. I really enjoy surgery a lot. And so I like the idea of being able to do surgery, which I would not be able to do as a family practitioner, most likely. When I did general surgery, I found it very exciting, but to a certain degree, I found it overwhelming. And so then when I did OBGYN, part of what I liked about it is since it dealt with just one area of the body, a little bit more confined, it gives you the same pleasure of doing surgery without having to deal with as many different, you know, body systems and all that. So I like the idea of specializing. It works well for me.
So I guess you would say you decided to do medicine by the time you entered college, and knew you were pre-med?
My junior year in college, I made the decision.
Junior year in college. Yeah. Okay, so thinking back to that point until even now, or until residency or whatever, can you tell me some of the high points and some of the low points of this whole saga of becoming a doctor?
Oh, boy.
You can start with the low points.
Start with the low points? Oh, boy. Let me think. Trying to think back and start in the beginning. I don't think college really had any low points as far as being pre-med, other than I always felt I had to work harder than a lot of other students, because the college that I went to, you had equal credit for your courses whether you had lab hours with it or not. Mm-hmm. So a lot of my friends were social science majors, and they'd be taking, we had three course loads, and so they would have a certain number of hours. I had that plus 4 or 5 hours of lab, and sometimes two labs in one semester, and it was all equal to the same credit. So that was really the only low thing there, was a lot of times I wished I had more free time in college to socialize and that sort of thing. But I found college difficult just as far as academically challenging, but I also had a lot of fun, so can't complain too much, especially compared to medical school.
And in college, were you a bio major?
Initially, I was a biology major. I changed over to English major, actually, interestingly enough, at the same time that I decided to do human medicine, partly because of the way scheduling worked with the courses that I would have had to take for the remainder of my college career. I would have had to take certain science courses because of when they were offered, not because I was interested in them. And once I made a definite decision that I was going to be pre-med rather than pre-vet, I had a better idea of exactly which courses I wanted. And I had taken a lot of the courses I needed for pre-med already at that point. And I really enjoyed literature from high school. And I had been taking English courses all along through college just because I enjoyed them. So it was an easy switch for me to make to an English major. I didn't have to take a lot of extra English courses to catch up. And it helped to lighten my load somewhat, and I was able to pick the biology courses and the chemistry courses that I wanted to take and balance that with the English, as opposed to having to choose them so they didn't, you know, conflict with other lab courses was really the main thing. So I didn't really have, like I say, too many low points in college. In medical school, trying to think. One thing that was difficult for me in medical school was that at Duke, you do your first 2 years of basic science, or what for most people is the first 2 years of basic science in 1 year.
Okay.
And that year was very difficult for me, in addition to the challenges of the work, doing it at an accelerated mm-hmm. pace. It was a pretty non-social year, is the best way to describe it. I mean, I could count the times that I went out to a party literally on two fingers, and even the times that I did, I ended up regretting it because I had work to catch up on. So it was a constant year of just classes and studying and eating and sleeping. I mean, there was no other way to get through it. The flip side of that, I guess a high point to throw it in here because of the timing is, my third year was what we call elective basic science. Mm-hmm. We had the option to do research or what they called upper level or advanced course science courses. And second year was when we did all of our clinical mm-hmm. rotations. And I, as I mentioned, I enjoyed all of those. And then my third year was kind of an easier year, so it was kind of a trade-off from the first grueling year of not being able to do anything. My third year, I was really able to explore a lot more extracurricular activities and also to just live a lot more normal life. I had no call schedule whatsoever, and I had even limited hours as far as there were very few days where I was either in the lab or in the classroom all day. So I was really able to do a lot more and get involved in some community service extracurricular activities, which is something that I wanted to do from the time I had gone to Duke, but I just never had the time. Mm-hmm. Graduation was definitely a high point of medical school, and as far as low points, I almost hate to say it, but almost all of my residency was a low point,
yeah.
Quite frankly.
That was in Springfield?
Yeah, it was very difficult both as far as hours and quite frankly, I didn't like the way I was treated as a resident, and even more so in retrospect.
Mm-hmm.
I think the residents need to be treated with a lot more respect and consideration than they are a lot of times. The third year of my residency, one of my friends got held back based on her CREOG scores. The CREOG is the in-service exam that OBGYN residents take. And as a result of that, my fourth year was definitely the worst time of all.
Because she wasn't with you?
Well, that was part of it. I mean, she was a friend, and that was sad to watch her have to go through that and everything. But more so than that, we had five residents in each year. She wasn't there, and one of the other residents that was supposed to go to the fourth year with us decided to go somewhere else because she didn't want to do the extra work, so she went and found her last year of residency somewhere else. So there were three of us doing five people's work, and we did have some support, thank God, from our attendings. They helped to cover some of the night call by staying in the hospital, which cut down our having to take every third night call all of a sudden after taking every fifth night call, which was nice. So we still had every fifth night call, but it still was very difficult because the day-to-day functioning of OBGYN residency, a lot of the responsibility for scheduling and reviewing charts, reviewing labs, running clinic, that sort of thing falls on the residents, and the three of us had to handle, you know, five people's work of that, and that was very difficult, and I felt extremely burnt out at the end of that year and extremely discouraged, and part of it was the extra work, and part of it was the lack of respect that I felt that I got as a resident in general, but particularly that year. I mean, I had incidences of attendings yelling at me because, literally yelling at me because there wasn't a resident to cover a surgery, to help cover a surgery, you know, things that were out of my control, you know, and yet, you know, I was left to take the brunt of it. I really didn't like that. In addition, like I say, the residency that I went to in Springfield, I think in particular, the residents should have been treated with a lot more respect. I mean, I think residents should not have to work as hard as they do and should make more money, you know, just like everyone else. But I think this was even a little beyond what I found in speaking to some other OBGYN residents and people I've spoken to since then, as far as the level of respect. So that was definitely a low point. And as a matter of fact, the only thing that really...
talking about your residency. Oh, I was going to ask you something, actually. I was going to ask you if, it was, if you know if it's the same way now at that place. Has it changed at all?
It's changed, yeah. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure how much for the better because I haven't talked directly with a lot of people there.
Mm-hmm.
But I do know that it has changed, you know, somewhat. So, oh, I know, I was getting ready to say, the main thing that really got me through that year was having the support of my family and friends. That was really the big thing. I had a lot of friends. My family's in the Boston area, and friends in Boston, and my boyfriend at the time, who's now my husband in Boston, and that year, almost every weekend that I wasn't on call, I drove to Boston for either to stay at my mother's house or to stay at my boyfriend's house because I wanted to get away, number one, and number two, I needed the support. And my husband was very supportive, too, in that sometimes even when I was on call on the weekend, he would come out to Springfield and cook for me and that sort of thing, so I didn't have to do too much even when I wasn't on. So that really is, you know, that kind of support is just invaluable when it comes to those kind of stressors. And let me see, since then, since I've been here, let's see, low points, I have probably easiest to hit. One of the lowest points was definitely going to take my oral boards.
Mm-hmm.
Extremely stressful.
How does that work?
Preparing for them was no fun either. You have to be at least a year out of your residency, and then you start preparing a list of patients that you have cared for, and I forget now, to be honest with you, the period of time. There's a certain period of time you have to collect every patient that you took care of, just a brief scenario that you submit. So you have to be approved to take the oral board, and then once you get approved, you go to wherever it's being offered, which for me was Chicago, and it's a one-day, half a day, really. You have three different examiners plus pathology slides that you have to look at, and it's just very grueling. It's very grueling.
Do you think I'm going to have to get certified as an OB-GYN?
Yeah, in order to be board certified, yeah, that's what you have to accomplish. So that was the tough part. Of course, the high point was getting my notification that I had in fact passed that examination. That was a real big one. And let me see what else. I think of too many other low points. I guess really the only other low point that I have is a case that had a bad outcome that I'm now involved in malpractice litigation for, which I can't go into detail, obviously, but that's definitely been a real low point, both as far as the actual occurrence and dealing with the adverse outcome, you know, of a pregnancy, as well as having to start learning to really deal with the whole legal system and all that entails is really very difficult. So that's it as far as low points.
How do you feel that your education at Duke prepared you for those, like, these legal things and the way medicine is changing so much that you always have to be looking over your shoulder?
Very little. Yeah, I mean, clinically, both at Duke and during my residency, I was taught a lot about documentation and defensive medicine and, you know, maintaining a standard of care. So, you know, the one thing I'm grateful for is that I was always cognizant of it in my training, and so it's just become a second habit, you know, you don't really think about it as you're practicing to a certain degree, you know, as far as documentation. Sometimes when I see how older physicians who are older than I am deal with documenting and how they write their notes and that sort of thing, I mean, it would never even cross my mind to abbreviate things to the point that they do or put things in the words that they do. Or not document in some cases like they do, because that's something that I just never, all the time I've been in medicine, it's been an issue.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess, you know, by that, you know, to that degree, I've really been trained for it. But as far as actually training you to deal with it, they really don't. We had seminars sometimes, especially during residency, where we, you know, talk about malpractice and medical legal. But as far as dealing with the legal system itself,
going back to when you left, I was going to ask you if you stuck around in New England for your undergrad. So how was it to go to the South? What was that like, especially being a black woman. And what was your class, the medical school class that you were in, like?
Going south was definitely nice. I liked it a lot. I found I liked the people in the south a lot better, just in general. The biggest thing I noticed as far as patients between north and south, just in general, I mean, obviously there's exceptions, the patients in the south were a lot more appreciative, a lot more patient, a lot less demanding, a lot more likely to say thank you, a lot more likely to understand that you had other patients that you had to take care of that might have delayed you, you know, getting to speak to them immediately, you know, that sort of thing. Going south was part of the reason why I chose Duke, in addition to the fact that it's an excellent opportunity. I wanted to see another part of the country and see what things are like. I didn't think I was ready for the deep south. So North Carolina seemed like a good place to go. And I love the weather. I could definitely take the weather down. And I like the sense of community. It's a lot stronger in the south, I think, even in cities like Durham than it is here. And in addition, I like the religious nature of life in the south. It seemed weird to me when I first went down there. Sunday, everything seems to almost come to a halt, or at least slow down, even slower than it already is. And of course, everything's slower paced down there too. But things kind of revolve around church on Sundays down there, and I kind of like that. I like that a lot. And I attended a lot of different types of churches. I was raised Catholic, but I don't really consider myself Catholic any longer, actually really since I went to college. So it was interesting. I went to all different kind of churches down there and had a lot of different religious experiences, different than what I think I ever would have gotten exposed to. If I had stayed up here, I would have just probably kept going to a Catholic church. So that was interesting. I didn't see a lot of North Carolina, partly just because of the fact that my studies kept me so busy. But I did do some work in some of the smaller communities in North Carolina, and I really liked it a lot. I don't really think that I had to deal with more prejudice down there than I did up here, being a black woman. If anything, the prejudice in the South is just a little more overt, but it's here too, at least as strong, if not stronger in some places. It just tends to be a little bit more covert and understated, you know, up here in the North. And when I went, after leaving North Carolina, I kind of noticed the difference in patients. I didn't really have a really good base to compare to. Going from college, I did some work with patients, and then going south, I noticed the difference. But I noticed an even bigger difference when I came back up here, as far as patients being demanding, impatient. And maybe some of it has to do with the urban areas and Boston. I think to a certain degree, that certain expectations are higher. But just in general, I found patients a lot more agreeable to work with down south. And for that matter, even just as far as business, I found, you know, just dealing with people more agreeable in the south.
And then you mentioned during your third year that you got involved with community service, community types of work. What types of things did you do? Was that through church? Or?
Actually, it was through the Student National Medical Association. Some of it was just things that we would sponsor, like blood pressure screenings and that sort of thing we would have at malls or churches or what have you. And then I did community work at a free medical clinic that was set up by Duke and staffed entirely by residents and medical students. And that was supervised patient care, which was interesting in the people that you saw, number one, and number two, in that you really got to function a little bit more independently and kind of feel more like you were a practitioner. There wasn't a lot of continuity, unfortunately, partly because you weren't there on a real regular basis. I mean, we only had so much time we could give. And then partly because, like most clinic situations, a lot of patients were not most compliant as far as follow-up. But I kind of felt like that was my first real taste of kind of, you know, being out in a community and serving a community, being a physician. I really like that. A lot. It was a lot of fun.
And have you been able to find a continuity here in your practice?
I have, yeah. That's one thing I like about being here. The way we run our practice here, we have patients are assigned specifically to one of us. We do cover each other for nights, weekends, and holidays, but I basically have continuity with, you know, most of my patients, except for the days that I'm not here. And even then, you know, if I come back from being on vacation or being on call,
messages are here for me, or one of my partners will grab me and tell me, you know, such and such went on with so-and-so, so that you do kind of have that feeling of continuity. And that feeling of getting to know people, especially with the obstetrics, but the gynecology too, but, you know, getting to know them and the struggles they're dealing with and helping them through those sort of things. So
you feel like you have a community, that you're working in a community?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Definitely. I mean, it's a lot bigger than what I felt down there, but it's just interesting because it's a much larger city, but dealing in a clinic situation down there, we were dealing with just really a portion of one community that this clinic served, because it wasn't that big. I mean, it was all, you know, it was partly funded from Duke and partly from donations and all that, but it could only serve, you know, about so many clients. It wasn't really that big of a clinic. But since I was a smaller community there, you know, you kind of got the sense of community a little bit more than you do in a big city like this will. We have a lot of people coming from the city. I mean, I say a lot, I mean, you know, thousands plus, a lot of people coming from the surrounding areas as opposed to, that was a clinic that served, you know, hundreds of people as opposed to thousands. But, yeah, one of the things I most love in general just about medicine and being here is the continuity of care that I have with my patients. It's very nice.
So you feel like you really can have a positive impact on people's health and on the way people, you mentioned preventative medicine.
Yeah, for sure. And as a matter of fact, I mean, I've never been in an HMO, but part of the reason why I thought about that when I first was looking into practice, but I didn't want to be in a group that was so large that patients would always constantly being shuffled off to another doctor as opposed to seeing me primarily. I think you lose some of that personal side of it when the group gets bigger. I mean, trade-off is you get to sleep more at night because your call schedule is better, but I like the idea of seeing my own patients more of the time and delivering more of my own patients than I would if I was in a group that was, you know, twice the size.
Mm-hmm. I want to get back to, well, I guess I'll ask that first. No, I'll ask these first because they're quicker. Do you have to work a lot of hours as opposed to an HMO where people might be able to get away with, you know, 9 to 6 or something? Do you feel like you're doing the traditional doctor's job?
Yeah, sort of. I guess maybe a little bit less than traditional. Because when I think of traditional, I think of, like, you know, my mother's obstetrician who, you know, was solo, and, you know, my mother, every time my mother would have a visit, it'd be 8 o'clock at night, you know, before she'd get home, because he covered everything himself, you know. I mean, that's a lot different. I mean, I take call roughly every third to fourth night, and, you know, a lot of that time I'm awake, and that's tough, but the days that I'm not on call, you know, I do try and structure my days such that, and limit my practice such that, you know, I have a reasonable day. It's not like I have a lot of nights where I'm, you know, dragging into the night 8, 9 o'clock, you know, to either seeing patients or calling patients or what have you. So, traditional, I guess, in the sense of, you know, following most of my own patients, being here most days. I do have one weekday a week that I take off, and that helps a lot. And then the time I cover is time I cover, but then the time when I'm not on call, I really consider that my time off. It's not time to be interrupted, and that's a little different, I think, than what I say. When I think of traditional, I think of, you know, people in my mother's generation, they had to be on call for everybody all the time almost, and so that's a lot different than that.
And do you see a lot of stability in this type of setting, work setting, as opposed to HMO, as opposed to what people say are the trends in healthcare? And
I wouldn't necessarily think it's a lot more stability, no. But see, it's hard for me to really, because I've never worked in an HMO, you know, I don't really fully know that experience, you know.
I guess what I'm trying to ask is, do you feel like you can continue in a setting like this without being threatened by HMOs or by these overarching trends in healthcare that say private practice is going to be out, that type of thing?
No, I think there's definitely a risk there, a threat, so to speak. A threat's kind of a strong word, but, you know, yeah, the pressure's always there, I think. You know, with the way that medicine is moving now, I do see where it eventually may be, where private practitioners or group practitioners really can't make it. I mean, as it is, I see a lot of HMO patients right now, and I'm subject to following rules of a lot of HMOs just because of insurances that the patients choose. So, I mean, private practice certainly isn't what it used to be as far as that's concerned. But it's different than actually being an HMO physician, I think, too. I have a little bit more flexibility as far as that's concerned. But, yeah, I never ever constantly aware of the possibility that this practice may not stay the same as it is, you know, forever and ever.
And when you were in med school, were you given the impression that your practice would be like this and that these threats would be there? And if not, knowing the way medicine is now and where it's headed, would you still have the same enthusiasm that you had before to go into medicine?
Well, in medical school, I really didn't have much thought about it, but a part of it, too, was there was not much emphasis on, like, say, the considerations as far as medical legal and, you know, just as they talk about a lot now for people like yourself that are in medical school learning the business side of medicine and, you know, economics and all that and all those implications. I mean, that really was not prominent at all in my medical education, so I really didn't think about it. I guess probably when I was in medical school, I always had the expectation this was generally the type of practice that I would be in even before I chose my specialty, and that I probably would be in this kind of practice for the rest of my life. I definitely see that differently now that I see the changes that have taken place since I was in medical school, you know, in medicine. Whether or not I have the same enthusiasm about it, probably not. A little less so. Yeah, a little less so, because it's definitely an imposition when you're in a position where you're set to make choices for a patient that wouldn't necessarily be the primary choice that you would make based on, you know, another governing body of people telling you, well, we're not going to pay for it if you do it that way. That can be discouraging. I mean, sometimes it's in the best interest of the patient, and in my opinion, sometimes it's clearly not, and that can be frustrating. So that has, you know, that's been a little bit of a disappointment as far as what, you know, what actually happens.
Okay, going back to the social things of medicine, you had mentioned before that there were certain things because of you being a woman, because of you being minority, there were certain struggles that you had to come against. I wonder if you could maybe mention a few of them, and also, more importantly, how you dealt with them and how you plan to deal with them as they come up, what your attitude is.
I think for me the biggest thing as far as discrimination, for me, being a woman has been more of an issue than being African American. One thing I did find in medical school, my class was fairly big. I mean, to me it seemed big, I guess is the way to put it. I don't really know how big.
How many?
It was, I don't know, 120, something like that. But
Was this in the 80s? When was this?
Yeah.
From 81 to 85?
83 to 87.
Okay.
Yeah. I would say almost exclusively, well, yeah, and definitely now in retrospect, since I haven't kept in touch with anybody, I really didn't develop any friendships with any of the white students in my class. The blacks at Duke in the medical school definitely dealt with discrimination. There's no two ways about that. But I'm not talking about stuff like name-calling and stuff like that. It was really, it's an institutional thing. I mean, there were things that happened when I was there where I saw black students judged by different standards than white students, namely more stringent standards, and that sort of thing. And what I found at Duke is what I found really a lot of times through my life as far as dealing with being a minority in this country and having to work hard to get to a certain point. I think most African Americans will tell you, and I certainly feel this way, that it's almost like you have to work harder to achieve the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
The other side of that, though, is you have to stick together. And in medical school, that was a lot of what helped me deal with the race discrimination. All of the black students at Duke basically hung together and supported each other. We studied together. The Student National Medical Association there, which is the African American Medical Association, we had regular meetings. We had regular duties that we did, the community service things that I mentioned to you, but as much as anything, we were there as a support for each other, and I had the constant support of my classmates at my same level as far as studying together, sharing notes, quizzing each other.
What percentage of your class
at Duke?
Black students then?
I think it was about 6%.
6%?
5 or 6%. Yeah, it was not high.
It's higher than you have.
The other thing that was nice about Duke, too, as far as support, the upper-level students were really, you know, always there.
Mm-hmm.
It's probably because of the way the system is set up at these...
I don't know.
Okay, we're back to, well, the first thing I was going to say before, the upper level students were always there to support the lower level students too, and part of that was because of the way Duke was set up, where the third year students, I mean, had a little more time on their hands. A lot of times they were willing, you know, to help out. They were always willing to, you know, answer questions as far as how to approach a certain rotation or a certain position or what have you. So that was a really, really big help. And I think it was about 6% of my class. 6%, not of my class, but 6% total there. Yeah.
And was it very much white and then black, or were there Asians? I'm sure there were a lot of Asians in med school.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Did they stick together too, or were they more integrated?
They were more integrated.
More integrated.
Yeah. And I don't think we didn't have significant number of Hispanic students or Native American students in my class. So, they were a lot more more integrated. So, but that was one of the things that that was good for me being in the South too. It's kind of fun sometimes, too, with the patients in the South, even more so than up here.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the African-American patients in the South are really appreciative to see a black physician.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes I'd walk in the room, I'd see a glow on the guy's face. The first thing out of his mouth would be, wow, you know, a black doctor. It was like a big deal, you know, for some of them, especially the ones that came from outside the city, you know, because they didn't see very much of that, I guess, you know. So that's kind of a nice feeling to know, you know, that you can be there for someone like that. And make that sort of difference. So, but the race issue definitely less of an issue than the gender issue. Yeah, I mean, I didn't have to deal with any direct overt racism. I would say through medical school and residency, but I did deal with sexism definitely, particularly during my residency. Just some comments that were made by attending physicians or sometimes even my fellow residents, just suggesting, you know, on various levels that they had less respect for me because of the fact that I was a woman.
Now, OBGYN has always been a very male specialty, and by the 80s, now I've heard that it's changing, or that they're accepting 50-50 into the residencies. And would you say, when you were there, was it still very male-oriented?
I guess that was probably kind of in the middle of that whole change, really, at least, well, for this area, you know, from what I've seen in this area. When I started my residency, it was mostly men. By the time I ended, we were over 50% women. So that's a definite change that took place while I was there. And, you know, from patients, it was not so much of an issue, and now even less so. I think as more and more women have the option to choose a woman physician, especially for their obstetrician gynecologist, more and more women are looking at it as a favorable thing. Although I have had women, you know, be surprised or make little comments as far as my being a woman. So that's definitely an issue. I only have had one incident in my life where the race has been an issue with a patient. When I was a medical student, I did have a patient at Duke that refused to have me care for him because I was black. That's the only time that's ever come up. And like I say, the thing that's different between the sexism and racism, you know, I've never had any overtly negative comments toward me because of my race as a physician, but I definitely have as far as my sex.
And how do you deal with that? Because it can happen at any moment or whatever. What is your general way of dealing with that, to be upfront?
Yeah, well, that's changed. When I first started dealing with it particularly, you know, and in medical school, you deal with it a little less directly because you're not directly responsible for the care of the patient, so it was less of an issue then. It was more just something I kind of took in and integrated back then and thought about more than anything else. Initially, during my residency, when I came up against it, especially if it was other physicians, my response was to try and ignore it initially. As time went on, I became more overt about it and let people know that I felt certain comments were not appropriate.
What kind of things, for example? Were they directed at you, or were they just...
Well, they're usually not, you know, directed, you know, intentionally right to you, but I mean, comments like, you know, as far as, particularly in OBGYN, the whole issue of surgery, and I think that's part of why, some people say that's part of why I became a male-dominated, you know, field. I overheard, you know, a resident, you know, making a comment about, you know, women not being good surgeons and that sort of thing. And the other thing, too, as far as the sexism, sometimes what would bother me most about attendings is comments that they would make, you know, being an OBGYN where they have all their patients are women, mm-hmm. and they would make comments generalizing women, mm-hmm. you know, as weak or whatever, mm-hmm. you know, whatever terms they would choose. Mm-hmm. And in those cases in particular, I really felt, more time went on and I found myself being a lot more outspoken mm-hmm. about letting them know that that's not the appropriate way, mm-hmm. first of all, to be looking at women, and second of all, to be talking about women, mm-hmm. especially when you have a woman who is essentially your equal standing right next to you, you know, that kind of thing. So, I won't say I, you know, took it upon myself, but on a certain level, with some of my attending physicians and some of my fellow residents, I made a real point that, especially if it was things that where they said things like that more than once, mm-hmm. To let them know I mm-hmm. found this inappropriate.
That's interesting. I was just thinking, as far as these men who have chosen to be gynecologists and obstetricians, and then having these attitudes. So I'm wondering, in your more cynical frame of mind, would you ever say? Would you ever make generalizations about the types of men who go into this field? Or would you find...
I wouldn't, only because I've seen all mm-hmm. types. I mean, I've seen some that I would, you know, just label as extremely sexist and extremely prejudiced, all the way to the, you know, to the other side. Mm-hmm. So I can't really say I would make a generalization, mm-hmm. really. I think, you know, in our country, really, honestly, my opinion is, you know, everyone has some degree of racism and everyone has some degree of sexism. And I think when it comes to sexism, particularly men toward women, so, I mean, some of it's to be expected from a man who's working, you know, primarily with women. But by the same token, that's part of why I found myself more and more speaking out against it, because, I mean, if anything, those are the men that need to be the most sensitive to their attitudes and their generalizations, which aren't true about all women, mm-hmm. you know, just like I don't feel I can make a generalization about, you know, all men.
I was thinking about you being in med school in the 80s, and that being around the time, if I remember correctly, that the AIDS virus came out, and what impact did that have on the curriculum, on you as physician?
It didn't have a big impact on the curriculum, because the virus was discovered, it was either the end of my third year of medical school or the beginning of my fourth year, I think, mm-hmm. somewhere in there.
Okay.
I can remember, well, my first year, I can distinctly remember in microbiology class discussing an infection, what they presumed was an infection that was associated with, you know, immunodeficiency, that was primarily in gay men, mm-hmm. and then, you know, as time went on, revealed, you know, IV drug abusers, et cetera, but they didn't know what it was then, and I can remember that very distinctly.
That was 83.
That was 83, yeah, 83 to 84. So it was in that next, like, year or two that, I guess it must have been part of, like, third year of my residency when they actually identified the virus, mm-hmm. and it made a lot of sense to me, you know, when they discovered it, just like I'm sure it did to a lot of other people. Mm-hmm. And I didn't really deal with AIDS in medical school.
I didn't really have
very many patients, no, that had it, that were diagnosed for sure with it. I think maybe a couple at the very end, mm-hmm. some of my fourth year rotations. But during my, actually, now that I think of it, I did do an internal medicine fellowship, that's what they call them, you know, rotation, mm-hmm. sub-internship, I guess mm-hmm. the other word for it, during my fourth year that I had a couple of patients that had it who were both drug users. Mm-hmm. And that was kind of difficult. It's been difficult getting used to the whole idea, as it has for everybody in this country, but residency was definitely different, because by then it was a lot more clearly established. Mm-hmm. You know, we really knew a lot more what we were dealing with, and it had a definite impact there. And Yeah, I think as much for practitioners as just, you know, population in general, obviously it's put a whole new thought on sexual intercourse mm-hmm. and exactly what that potentially entails. Mm-hmm. And certainly I'm sure I learned a lot more about the, you know, preventative measures mm-hmm. for sexually transmitted diseases than I would have learned yeah. if AIDS, you know, didn't exist. I dealt with AIDS patients throughout my residency, although not in great numbers, mm-hmm. but we always had some patients that we knew were HIV positive. Mm-hmm.
I wanted to ask, how about what you feel, I got the sense that from your medical school experience, you really felt part of a community, and the bastions helped each other and that type of thing, and what was your residency like? Did you feel like you were just tossed out there in a community that didn't have a lot of African Americans in medicine? And same thing here. And also, how do you participate in community in Worcester, and what is it like? My personal experience here is there weren't a lot of African Americans, more Latinos, and I'm just wondering how you participate in the life.
Well, in my residency, I was the only African American OBGYN resident mm-hmm. in my residency throughout my entire 4 years. Mm-hmm. There was one Hispanic woman that was a couple of years behind me. I did, to a certain degree, bond with some of the other African-American residents in other specialties mm-hmm. during residency, but of course there wasn't a lot of time there either mm-hmm. to really, you know, socialize. And the other thing, too, is since I kind of had a social life in Boston already, since I had friends and family in Boston already, and my tendency was to get away from Springfield, I didn't really become all that involved in the community there other than I did belong to predominantly African-American sorority in college, and I participated in the local chapter in Springfield for 2 years until I found I just wasn't able to attend meetings regularly enough to keep doing that. So there really weren't enough other black doctors around as there were to have that feeling of community like I had in medical school with the other black medical students. Also, too, the difference in medical school, the other black medical students, you know, we're all following a common path,
yeah,
so
exactly.
We had the, you know, that proximity of the experience we're going through, as opposed to in residency, like, say, in OBGYN, I was the only one, you know, for 4 years. There were two black attendings mm-hmm. Where I trained, and I definitely would say I got to know them better, you know, than any of the other attendings that I dealt with, although I didn't, can't really say I socialized, you know, with them, but, you know, that, there's a certain connection that's there, mm-hmm. you know, that it's almost automatic in some cases, and it certainly was with these two people, particularly supportive of me, you know, in word, if not in deed, you know, or both. And same thing here, really. I mean, there aren't enough African-American doctors in this community, mm-hmm. Together with there's not enough time in my life mm-hmm. to really, you know, extend myself to really consider that a community that I'm really a big part of. My community service has decreased as my practice has become busier, mainly because of time constraints,
mm-hmm.
And also because of my marriage and my desire to, you know, maintain a certain level of relationship with my husband in spite of the fact that he's busy. So I always imagined that when I was in practice, I would continue to do a lot of community service mm-hmm. work, but I found it to be more than I can really handle mm-hmm. right now. So I haven't been that active in the black community in Worcester. I've attended some of the black churches, but I have found they're not quite right for me.
Mm-hmm.
So that has kept me from getting to know a lot of blacks outside of medicine, and there aren't a lot in medicine.
Exactly.
And say my social life, my friends at this point primarily are in Providence and Boston, mm-hmm. More so than Worcester. So I'm in a similar situation, I guess, as I was in Springfield. But when I do have the time off to, you know, to go be social, I'm usually leaving Worcester,
uh-huh.
Not because I don't want to be here, but because I have, you know, attraction with other places. You know, my husband and I both have godchildren, you know, in different places. So, you know, that kind of takes me away.
Mm-hmm.
And I primarily look at my community service here as being involved in the community and the free care mm-hmm. that I give to patients that you know, don't have insurance,
mm-hmm.
Either through support of patients that come in to be seen in the hospital
mm-hmm.
that do not have a physician, or I see patients in my office sometimes, and I'll either have them not charge them or give them a reduced
mm-hmm.
price depending on their, you know, financial status. So that's what I look at now is,
mm-hmm.
you know, the extent of my involvement in community service. I would at some point in the future like to have more of an involvement where I may be involved specifically in a program that services a certain
mm-hmm.
part of the community. I did do some work the first couple of years that I was here, I'll say work, but I did some volunteerism with speaking to local high school students and speaking at churches.
Mm-hmm.
I went to two separate churches. One of them actually was a church in Rhode Island that I got invited to through an association through a pastor that I met. Just doing general women's health education in kind of an open forum sort of thing. So I'd like to do more of that, but right now my priorities are in other places as I'm beginning to think about starting a family and say a lot of my friends have started families, so that's a real attraction for me at this point.
How many years have you been married?
Since 92.
92.
Yeah, I just celebrated my fourth anniversary.
Thanks. What kind of, and then since we've been talking, there's, now that work has really become a huge priority in your life, it's taken up a lot, and what other types of things, besides the community work, in terms of just balancing lives, there's your husband, your marriage, and your work, and then if you have kids, how do you think you're going to handle all of that?
Oh, I don't know, actually. I think about it a lot, but I don't know, probably until, you know, until I get there.
Mm-hmm.
I do think it will involve cutting back some on my practice, because I don't think I can continue the same number of hours that I'm working right now
mm-hmm.
and give enough time, you know, to my children. And it's going to probably involve cutting back some on socializing. Too, although, like I say, since a lot of my friends are having children, you know, some of that getting together will be, you know, supporting each other, taking care of each other's kids sort of thing, as opposed to getting together just to party. But, of course, it's a different type of socializing you do, I guess, as you get older. But it's going to be a hard balance for me, for sure, because I don't want to really consider myself really a fully part-time type of physician, you know, where I'm not available for my patients at least most of the time, but by the same token, nothing's more important to me than my family. My biggest social outlets right now are spending time with my husband, his friends and my friends, and then I really do like the fact that my family is still close. I mean, that's something that when I initially made the decision to come back to Massachusetts, it was almost out of necessity, you know, to have the support. Now it's just kind of nice to have it, you know, I could do without it, but it is kind of nice to be able to, you know, jump in my car and get together with my brother and sister or have them bop out, you know,
mm-hmm.
to my house. My brother and my sister and I are very close.
And they're all in Massachusetts?
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah, my brother and sister both live in the Boston area, so I really enjoy that a lot.
Okay, we can go for a little bit because it was going to be about an hour, so we'll just finish up this tape.
Okay.
I wanted to ask you a little bit about the types of patients that come here. Is it a cut of the population?
I think I see the broad spectrum with, you know, obviously a little bit more emphasis toward, you know, middle class
mm-hmm.
As opposed to lower class.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's probably typical for most private practices, you know, in the urban area. I do, as I mentioned, deal with some of the clinic patients through the service that we do in the hospital. Everyone on staff covers patients that don't have physicians, and a lot of times those are the patients that are uninsured or on Medicaid or what have you. And then any of those patients that I see subsequently become my, I consider them my patient, unless
mm-hmm.
they prefer to, you know, if they've been seen already in the clinic here at the hospital, they usually prefer to go back there. I think it's pretty much an average cut compared
mm-hmm.
to what most, you know, what most people will see. I don't think I really see a lot of the real upper class, but most of the people that I see, you know, are insured.
Mm-hmm.
And racially, it's a nice mix for me. My practice is definitely predominantly white. There's no question about it. But I think I see more
African-American patients than my partners do, partly because of, primarily because of patients referring other African-Americans to me. I reached a certain point in my practice where I realized it was starting to grow based on referrals, patients referring their friends and their family, and it was that point where I started noticing significant Black population as opposed to just representative Black population, although I say definitely predominantly my practice is white. I see probably a little bit less Hispanic population than Dr. Fiercy because he speaks fluent Spanish and I don't. I'm working on it. I've been wanting to learn to speak Spanish for a long time. But those little things, you know, can have influences. But, you know, I think my group is pretty typical. I mean, I find most of my patients I get along with real well. There's a couple that I have really close relationships with. I mean, it's professional still. It's not a friendship, but they seem more open, you know, to talk to me as opposed to others. And then there's always the problem patients, the ones that are constantly calling with the same problem or constantly challenging you, that sort of thing. You know, it's always the difficult patients, drug-seeking patients, that sort of thing. But it's all things you learn to deal with. But it's a real transition from residency where you're dealing with, you know, primarily lower class, you know, population from the clinic, at least where my residency was. As far as seeing people on an outpatient basis, they were all pretty much predominantly MassHealth, you know, Medicaid patients. And we did assist in caring for the private patients, but it was on kind of a limited level as far as assisting with surgeries, assisting with deliveries. We would write the history and physicals and that sort of thing. But you never really got to know those people because you never really saw them, you know, again and again, as opposed to the ones that you saw in the clinic. So I like having the variety. You know, I mean, the challenge of dealing with the tougher patients and the socially challenged patients, it definitely has its rewards, especially when you have good outcome. Dealing with it all the time, it gets to be tiring. I have a lot of respect for people who choose to be in a practice where they're dealing with that all the time, and especially these days where something like that is financially very, you know, difficult to do. And that's a really big limiting factor, but I think it's fairly representative.
Okay, is there anything you want to add?
No,
so you'd say the way your practice is still changed, and obviously you haven't done your family or that you want to do, but the course that things are taking with your career and with respect to other aspects of your life, you feel pretty poised for what's going on?
Yeah, pretty much. I found it a little tougher dealing with the lack of sleep as I get older. That's the only big problem that seems to be coming up that's kind of unexpected, so to speak. I mean, not totally unexpected, but somewhat unexpected for me right now, because I don't think of myself as that old, but it does seem as the years go on.
The tolerance goes down,
and of course, the obstetrics, you just have to do it, so it does make a little bit, that's been a little different, and as far as questions in my mind for the future, I must admit sometimes I do say to myself, well, how am I going to do this when I'm 45 instead of 35, you know, and then 50, but we'll see.
Okay. All right, thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you.